So the subject is Mahavakyas, four great statements in Vedanta. Maybe this term Mahavakya needs some introduction, especially to those who are not familiar with the Upanishadic philosophy. So once we get an idea of this Mahavakya, we will understand how profound and how relevant it is to our times. Mahavakya means great statement, a great statement. It need not necessarily be in the form of a full sentence. It could sometimes be in the form of a phrase or just a few words put together. Now, most of you know the Vedanta philosophy, the Vedantic way of life, the Hindu tradition, and in fact, even the Buddhist religious tradition had their origin in the Vedas. Whatever you read in the original scriptures of Buddhism or Jainism or Sikhism or the Zoroastrian religion, as well as Hinduism and Vedanta, they're all rooted in the Vedas. The Zoroastrian tradition is just is one of the offsprings of the Vedic tradition. So also Buddhism. Buddhism is nothing but a humanistic interpretation of the Vedic way of life, the Vedic philosophy. So also Sikhism, all these different traditions. Most of the religious traditions that had their origin in Asia are rooted in the Vedic heritage. And you know there are four Vedas: Rigveda, Yajurveda, Samaveda, and Atharvaveda. These are the four Vedic literature. Even if you read the original canon of the Zoroastrian religion, even the language is very close to the language of the Rigvedas. Any person who knows Sanskrit very well, the old Sanskrit, will understand much of what is written in the Zoroastrian tradition. Now, these four Vedas have four great statements which constitute the very foundation of Vedanta philosophy and Vedanta heritage. Today, if you are talking about interspirituality or, you know, this concept, I am not religious but spiritual, it comes from the Vedas, because the Vedas teach us that you can be spiritual, you can be universal, you can become a very good human being without the help of religion as it is understood in the conventional language. I don't think there is any spiritual tradition which tells you that if you are a good human being, if you are compassionate, if you are pure in heart, if your actions are unselfish, if you look upon your fellow human beings with love and compassion, then God is not very particular that you should accept him. He doesn't bother. That's enough so far as he is concerned. This idea is a unique feature of Vedic tradition. As I said, you know, there are four Vedas. In these four Vedas, there are four great statements. For example, in the Rig Veda, there is one great statement. It's called Prajnanam Brahma. I will come to that later. It comes in one of the Upanishads which belong to Rigveda. It's called Aitareya Upanishad. In the Yajurveda, there is another statement, Aham Brahmasmi. It comes in the Shukla Yajurveda, in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. In the Samaveda, there is one statement, Tattvam Asi. That's what we are going to deal with today. We will deal with other statements later. It comes in the Chandogya Upanishad. Then there is Atharvaveda. There is I am Atma Brahma, which comes in the Mandukya Upanishad. Now, you know, what do these statements tell us? It doesn't say anything about God, creation. It tells us what we are and what the absolute universal truth is. Of these four statements, it's very interesting. The first statement in the order of spiritual evolution is Tattvamasi. It is called Upadeshavakya, means a teacher instructs his disciple. If you read the statement with this English translation or any translation, it may not make any sense, unfortunately. But Shankaracharya has written a commentary running to several pages on this statement. Now, what does this statement mean? What is the context? So just to give a brief idea, then I will come to the subject and relevance of these statements. This itself will tell us. A young boy in ancient times, in ancient India, is getting his instruction from his father, who is also his teacher. Of course, he is not a very young person, as we will understand when we go to the text, which we'll do later. The story comes, for those of you who are interested, in the sixth chapter of the Chandogya Upanishad, which is a part of the Samaveda. Now, I shall give the background, then I will come to the statement. The statement is repeated 9 times. The disciple was not deaf, hard of hearing. But the disciple had already studied, had gone through 12 years of training in the ancient Vedic canonical literature, in grammar, in philosophy, and in innumerable areas of learning. The list of the branches of learning of ancient times you'll find in the Chandogya Upanishad, the 7th chapter. All the 4 Vedas, you know what all sciences are mentioned? Astronomy, astrology, mathematics, medical science. You know your Ayurveda is ancient times. And mind you, this mathematics, this Vedic mathematics, a number of branches are mentioned. This boy, when he had already studied, but when the father asked him, did you study? Did you learn that? Did you have that learning which makes you wise? Which makes you aware of what you have learned? You know, in learning, there are 2 fundamental processes in ancient epistemology. One, you learn something, and then your own awareness of what you have learned and your own knowledge of how to make use of what you have learned. There are 2 stages in the process of learning. If you have learned something, and if you do not know you have learned, then our knowledge is of no use. So we should first of all know something, and then we should have the awareness in our mind of what we have learned. The awareness comes from a higher spiritual awareness. So the story goes like this. In ancient times, there was hermitage. The father, his name was Uddalaka. His son's name was Shvetaketu. In fact, they appear as teacher and disciple in this particular context, in the sixth chapter of Chandogya Upanishad, which comes from the Samaveda. This father was a great Vedic scholar, a pandit. So he was traveling all over Indian subcontinent, which at that time you should remember, today's Afghanistan, Pakistan, some of the Central Asian republics were all included in the ancient heartland of Vedic heritage, Vedic culture. So he was moving in all these places. For 12 years, he was away from his home. And he was spending a few years in one Vedic hermitage, teaching the students there. Then he will spend a few more years in another hermitage. Like that, he was away from his home for 12 years. Before he left his home, he had already made some arrangements for his son to go to a nearby Vedic school, Vedic hermitage, another great teacher who was supposed to teach him. But the boy had neglected his education. So after a long time, when the father returned home, he found the boy had completely neglected his education. Then the father scolds him, "Look here, you should not become a disgrace to your family. You are born as a Brahmin, you didn't study the Vedas, you neglected your education, it's a shame for you and for our family." You know, in ancient oriental tradition, family prestige is very important. This is a special feature of the oriental cultures. So, and the boy was very much upset. Anyway, he was willing to go to the school. The father will not teach the student, the son, normally. Maybe some initial education, because if the father teaches his own son throughout, one problem is, if the son becomes negligent or lazy, he may not punish him properly. His love, his parental affection may stand between the son and his proper education. So he will send his own son to another Vedic teacher. That's a tradition. So when his father returned, he found the son had completely neglected his education. So he sent him to Vedic school. And after 12 years, the son returns. He thought, well, Shvetaketu, the son had received a very good education. So he will be very polite, you know, education. You know, education should not make us arrogant. It should make us aware of what we have learned, but that awareness should not become haughtiness or false pride. But in the case of Shvetaketu, in this story, Shvetaketu, the father found, Uddalaka, the father found that Shvetaketu, his son, had become very haughty and proud of his learning. False pride. So father wants to bring some wisdom into his heart, in his mind. What makes you so haughty and proud? Have you learned that learning? Did you have that learning which really makes you wise? You know, there is some kind of learning that we can have from a university. But university can make us monsters. University also can make us saints, sages. The university can produce an Aristotle. University can produce also a Hitler. Education without some internal value that trains our heart and trains our mind and creates certain attitudes in our life, which we should reflect in our interaction with other people. That kind of education is not very productive, it's not very constructive, and could often be destructive. So in the case of Shvetaketu, the father had a strong suspicion that this fellow had not really learned that which makes a person wise. So he wanted to make him humble. Did you learn that? Then the son said, well, I have never heard of such a branch of learning which makes a person wise, by knowing which the unknown becomes known, by knowing which the unheard becomes heard, by knowing which all other learning becomes productive. The son said, well, I have never even heard of that. And interestingly, if you go to that text, you find he says, well, maybe my teachers also did not know about it, because I'm a very brilliant student. So if my teachers did not teach me that, it means they also did not know. So Shankaracharya, in a mischievous way, puts an idea. He was afraid he will be sent back to the school. So he wanted to tell his father, my teachers also did not know, so don't bother to send me again to the school. So, but then the father tells him, look here, there is such a thing which makes you wise, which makes you aware of what you have learned, and which teaches you to make proper use of what you have learned for your good and for the good of others. And that knowledge is enshrined in this particular small statement. You find if a translation will not make any sense, tat tvam asi. This is the statement. In this, I shall continue this class of, I mean, in another occasion, maybe on December 20th, the same class will, same lecture will continue. So I'm trying to give a full background. Later on we'll come to the text. So I want to give you this example, tat tvam asi. What it means is this. The literal meaning is, this subtle truth, this subtle principle, this is the essence of the whole creation. It is the self of the whole creation. There is one supreme reality, the Atman, which resides in all of us, and which is the omnipresent, all-pervading reality. And it is not far away from you. It is your own inner self. Now, this is one statement. Now I shall come to the relevance of these statements, because this is going to be fairly elaborate discussion. You must have heard, if you have read Swami Vivekananda's complete works, you know Swami Vivekananda repeated again and again that I have never taught in the West, I have never taught anything other than the Upanishads. You know, right now there are 9 volumes available, 10th volume, of course, coming. And you can also read Gargi's 6 volumes. You can also read several other writings, lectures of Swami Vivekananda. Vivekananda repeats this statement again and again. I have never taught anything other than the Upanishads. And Upanishads means what? The whole of Upanishads, the meaning, the messages are all condensed in these 4 statements. I have just given you this one of the statements. The full text is, Saya esha anima aidudatmi midam sarvam tat satyam sa atma tattvamasi shvetaketu. The first instruction, it comes in the 9th Brahmana of the 6th chapter, and it continues all the way to 16th Brahmana. Total, every time, whenever the father repeated this instruction, The son requested his father, please teach me again, please teach me again. Bhuya eva mam vijnapayatu. Please repeat this statement again. So the father repeats this instruction. First statement, then 8 repetitions, total 9 instructions. Now, Vivekananda says, I have not taught anything except the Upanishads. If you read the Chicago addresses, if you read Inspired Talks, if you read the written presentations of Swamiji's lectures in Oakland, in the Unitarian Church, or in the Thousand Island Park, anywhere in America or England or Europe or in India, Swamiji says he has not taught anything but the Upanishads, which means he did not teach anything other than the essence of these 4 great statements, Mahavakyas. And what do they contain? As I said earlier, it tells you one truth. God is not a person who creates this world and sits outside of you. God, in his essence, resides in our hearts and in the hearts of everyone, everything in this world. So the creation, existence, humanity is one. The whole human society is one spiritual family. You can realize this inner spiritual reality either by practicing unselfish action, whether you're working in the office, in your home, in the university, whatever may be your job, all these activities, all these physical, intellectual, mental activities can be converted into a spiritual practice. And if you do that, the God that is sitting, residing within our hearts will start manifesting. And our actions, our thoughts, our attitudes will become godly, divine. So, you can do this not only through unselfish action, karma yoga, but also by controlling your mind, or through philosophical analysis, or as we do in the popular monotheistic religions, by going to a church or a temple or a Buddhist temple or anywhere, or Jewish temple, anywhere, and praying to God. So all these activities will help us to experience the presence of the divine reality within us. Once we do that, then we will look upon the whole humanity as one spiritual family. This is the essence of all the 4 Mahavakyas that we are going to deal with again and again. And as I said earlier, Swamiji said, Swami Vivekananda said, that I have not taught you anything but the Upanishads. Why did he choose to teach the Upanishads? Why did he choose to teach this particular spiritual ideal? You know, when Vivekananda came to this country, as you know, the first lecture was in 1893, September 11, the Parliament of Religion. Now, what was the intellectual, the cultural landscape of Europe or America in the later half of 19th century? The world had seen enough of organized religions. The world has had enough of some kind of fanatical belief in God, our God, and our way of practicing our religion. And the world was, in fact, it was tired of listening to this kind of religion. Not that these religions were wrong, they were right. But the way they were understood, the way they were interpreted, humanity had enough of it. So, When Karl Marx wrote Das Kapital, and with the help of Engels, he published the Communist Manifesto. And when Darwin published his Original Species, and when so many scientific discoveries took place in Europe mostly in those times, we challenged the belief systems of organized religions, which divided humanity into conflicting groups of believers and non-believers, which offered promised heaven to the believers and threatened with hellfire to the non-believers. People had enough of this kind of religion. Remember, religion was not at fault. Vivekananda repeats that again and again. But modern human civilization was looking for something that is universal. That did not insist that you should believe in something even if you don't have any experience. You should believe in a God whom you cannot see, with whom you can communicate only with the help of an intermediary, an institution, or a priest. So the world was looking for a new religious paradigm. And again, modern scientific discoveries and modern philosophical thought currents like positivism challenged the very foundations of organized religions. Does morality depend upon faith? Sometimes, you know, people interpreted religion as some kind of an understanding. My God is very good towards me, so I can do whatever I want. So my God will support me in whatever evil things I do. This sort of belief systems. Now, Vivekananda, when he traveled in Europe after visiting America, or during his early stage of traveling in this country, he encountered these problems. So I should tell you, you know, according to modern historians, the cultural landscape of the United States in the later decades of the last 3-4 decades of 19th century are often studied from 3 different perspectives. At the highest level was a small group of highly intellectual, extremely well-educated, somewhat Eurocentric intellectuals who studied maybe Original Species and the European philosophical schools, and also American mystical works like works of Emerson, Thoreau, Whitman, and others. And the Professor Wright, whom Swamiji met during his travels, and who recommended Swamiji in the highest terms, he was a professor of Greek, highly educated, evolved American intellectual, was somewhat Eurocentric. Eurocentricism was the hallmark of American intellectual culture in the later half of 19th century. Then there were other 2 groups, either the extremely conservative evangelical Christian groups, and also people who were not so well educated. I'm not going to that extent. Now, Swamiji primarily had to address people who were aware of the intellectual movements emerging in Europe. So he found that what modern world, Western world, was looking for was a universal spiritual paradigm. And interestingly, he thought, if you have this paradigm, and if you read the Bible, the Sermon on the Mount, you find new gems and diamonds, new meanings, new spiritual treasure in the Bible. With this perspective, if you read any religious scripture, you'll find that every religious scripture contains some universal spiritual ideas. So that's why Vivekananda said, if a person who knows Vedanta will find new meanings in the teachings of Jesus, in the teachings of Buddha, in the teachings of other teachers. So Swami Vivekananda wanted to interpret religion on the basis of the Upanishads, Because the Upanishads present before us a universal spiritual paradigm. It is humanistic. So Karl Marx and Engels, these socio-economic political thinkers of 19th century, could not criticize religion as anti-humanistic. Remember, when Vivekananda traveled in India and Europe and America, Marxian thought had not become a Marxian ideology. It was one school of thought, one celebrated thought system studied in European universities. In a way, you know, it is a continuation of the evolution of socialism, you know, the Fabian socialism, then utopian socialism, and Marxian socialism. So remember, we should always remember, when Vivekananda lived and taught and preached, he often uses the word socialism. You'll be surprised. One statement of Vivekananda, if I quote, even Marx would be proud if he could ever put such a wonderful statement. We couldn't. I am a socialist not because it's a perfect system, but because half a loaf is better than no bread. That is what Swami Vivekananda says. Pure radical humanism. Pure humanism. So, during Vivekananda's time, when he traveled in Europe and America, there were many modern thinkers who criticized religion as being anti-humanistic. Swamiji wanted to say that true religion, whether true religion based on the teachings of Jesus or Buddha or Vedanta or Hinduism, true religion is not anti-humanistic. Religion interpreted by the church, the institutionalized religion may end up being anti-humanistic. But true religion is not anti-humanistic. Rather, true religion teaches a kind of universal spiritual humanism. It is humanism, but not a lopsided humanism like the capitalist or socialist or economic socialism. It is a kind of humanism. It is kind of universal humanism, and it is spiritual humanism. Because it is humanist theory built on the belief that God lives in our hearts. Not only in my heart, but in your heart also. That is the meaning of the statement, Tattvamasi. You know what Uddalaka tells his son? You are that. He doesn't say you alone, but I also. The whole humanity, God, is that supreme universal spiritual principle. Atman. Atman is the highest understanding of the absolute reality. The inner consciousness, the divine reality. It lives within our hearts. So if you can have a humanistic philosophy based on this, it doesn't draw lines between cultures, nationalities, families, or races, or linguistic groups. It accommodates the whole humanity into one spiritual family. So he said, what the Upanishads teach is a kind of universal spiritual humanism. Again, Vivekananda said that it is not opposed to science. That is another major problem. With the publication of The Origin of Species, many agnostics and atheists and even believers started criticizing the Genesis, the biblical Genesis. And also back in India, they started criticizing some of the old conservative principles of popular monotheistic Hinduism. So organized religion started facing a big problem. So Swami Vivekananda said, religion, true religion, interpreted as universal spiritual humanism, as taught in the Upanishads, as enshrined in the great statements like Tattvamasi, is not unscientific. Because it doesn't ask you to believe in something that you don't see, that you don't experience. So he said, religion is a manifestation of divinity already man. Religion is the experience. Religion is spirituality. So belief is not the foundation of true religion. experience is the foundation of true religion. Science also is built upon experience. Experience of scientists who performs experiments in the laboratories. So Vivekananda said, experience is the foundation of true religion. Now, you know in the statement what the father Uddalaka tells Shvetaketu. He says, you should experience this. How do you experience this? You meditate. You think. You lead an unselfish life. You make your actions, your thoughts, your attitudes, your whole life unselfish, pure. And then you find within your heart the divine reality, divine spirit manifests. So you'll find the presence of God within you. And you also feel the presence of God everywhere. So within our heart, we realize the immanence of the Lord. And outside, you experience the omnipresence of the Lord. So that makes us better human beings. So true religion is the most sublime form of universal spiritual humanism. It is also the most scientific analysis of the subject as what we are, who we are. So he says, this Atman, see, Saya esha anima aitadabhim idam sarvam tasatyam sa atma tattvamasi shetaketu. So that subtle principle, the divine spark, it lives within us, is the essence of the whole creation, the whole universe. And that divine spirit lives within you, within all of us. It's a great statement. Now, when I know that there could be many questions that could arise in our mind. When a father tells his son, you are dad, how can such a statement contain such a profound implication? See, if somebody tells you are God or God lives in you, we will be surprised. We would rather be shocked sometimes. If you take in the literary sense. So Vedantic hermeneutics presents three types of interpretation. It's related to the hermeneutics, the science of interpreting scriptures. Perhaps I should give an idea of this to make this point clear. Because if you read a text and if you read the translation, well, the father tells the son, you are dad. And this is a wonderful statement. I don't think people will be impressed. But the statement is there. The point is this. Here, in this statement, tattvam asi, in English perhaps, that thou art. You are that. That's the meaning. What is you here? When Uddalaka addressed his son Shvetaketu and he said, you here doesn't stand for that particular person in the form of his son or his disciple, Shvetaketu. That you here stands for not a human being, not the body embodiment, but the divine spark present in you. So, if we look upon ourselves, what are we after all? From an external point of view, empirical point of view, we can say, I'm this body. Or maybe when I read a book and I say, this is a wonderful book, you can say, I am the intellect. If I feel hungry and thirsty, if I'm angry, I can say I'm the mind. So, depending upon the context, we interpret ourselves from different angles, from different perspectives. But who is the real I? The real I, according to Vedanta, is the immanent, the inner resident, the Atman, the consciousness that is residing within us. It manifests through this physical, psychophysical mechanism, which is constituted by this complex body, mind, and intellect. But behind and beyond these empirical, physical, intellectual, psychological dimensions, there's a spiritual dimension of the real I, and that spiritual dimension is the consciousness, the Atman, the self, capital letter, yes, self, the resides us. So the father says, you here, not the son, the physical body, but the Atman residing in you is that reality that we are talking about. A long discussion takes place before this statement is made. At the end of a long discussion of this self, of this Atman, this discussion will come to that later through different examples. There are 8 examples, great examples, 9 repetitions of the statement in the text. We'll come to that later. But I want to give this meaning. So, according to the hermeneutics involved in interpreting the scriptures, the meaning of you is not a human being, but rather the divine spark that is the real essence of the real I. That Atman is the universal, all-pervading, immanent, transcendental reality. That is one. And that exists everywhere. That is all-pervading. So, the literal meaning of the statement is not taken. The implied meaning is taken. So if you read the book, you find lakshyartham means the real implied meaning. The real meaning, the implied meaning, the true implication is the you is the Atman, the self, the immanent self consciousness residing in all of us. The literal meaning could be a human being, you know, body, mind, complexion, so on. So it is called Lakshanavrti. This particular method of analysis is called Lakshanavrti. Of course, those who know more about it, you can ask me later. You can ask questions on this when we are in the class here. So there's a, so manantaro aparadhi mukhyasyarthi aparigrahe jati mukhya vina krudertheya vrti saiva Lakshanavrti. This is a particular kind of hermeneutical method by which the literal meaning, which is really, irrelevant, is removed, and the true meaning, the implication, the implied meaning is taken up. This is how the Vedanta, these 4 Vedas, explain these great statements. Now, coming to the next. I'm just giving a bird view in today's class. When a disciple, when a student listens to this great instruction, what does he do? He should not go and sleep. Oh, I'm God, fine. He'll be very happy. No. It is, the instruction is not that you are God. The instruction is simple. The true essence of God, the divine reality that is all-pervading, the immanent, the transcendental reality, that spiritual reality is present in you. That's the meaning. We should not mistake that the father tells the son, you are God. No. The father only tells the son, look here, you have studied all the scriptures, all the wonderful branches of learning. But that has not made you a wise person, spiritual wisdom. Information can give you knowledge. Knowledge and information should become wisdom to be really fruitful in our life. That wisdom comes out of a kind of inner experience. Wisdom is the spiritual dimension of information and knowledge. Information's could be disconnected bits, information, different things. When you organize this information, we call it knowledge. When we evolve still further, we become wise, because at that stage, we'll be able to make proper use of this knowledge and to avoid making improper use of the same. So, when a teacher tells this, the student starts his spiritual practice. You should meditate. You should practice internal purity. You should practice purity, unselfishness, all humanness, compassion, all these qualities in his actions, in his thoughts, in his attitudes. And then he should go through a process of spiritual preparedness. I mean, he should become fit for this experience. Right now, it is only a theoretical knowledge. The theoretical knowledge should become experience. Because we go through these four levels of evolution. First, in spiritual life. First, we start with rituals, belief systems. We go to pray. We read scriptures. That is great. And then we get some convictions with philosophy. And then we get a glimpse of the higher truth. And finally, we ourselves should have an experience of this truth. Now, when we reach the experience dimension, then religion becomes spirituality. So spirituality is not an empty doctrine. Sometimes in modern times, I have some encounter with some great exponents of this particular motto, I'm spiritual, not religious. So very, very, very often, when people say that, it only means, well, I'm not willing to go through the disciplines required for a religious person. But if you are a religious person, you have to go to church, you have to pray, at least you have to show some external discipline. But if you sit in your home and say, well, I'm spiritual, with a great sense of pride in her words, you know, that doesn't make us spiritual. Spirituality goes beyond religion. It is not rejection of religion. So all the internal disciplines, inner disciplines that we practice in religion, all the vows that we practice as part of internal discipline, we must know proper, in the proper sense of the term. And then when we practice unselfishness, purity, inner purity, in our action, words and thoughts, when we spiritualize our whole life, our actions, our thought currents, then only we become spiritual. Not just by believing that we are spiritual, we don't become spiritual. The way where I believe in Kant, so you may be called a Kantian. I believe in the teachings of utilitarian philosophy, you may be called a utilitarian. You may believe in the teachings of maybe in the evolution theory, you may be called an evolutionist. No. That way we cannot become spiritual. We become spiritual only when we reach the experience dimension of this instruction. So the student withdraws, then he practices, he practices this discipline. And for this practice, there are two great statements which are again repeated, that is Prajnanam Brahma and Ayamatma Brahma. And at the end, at the fourth stage, when the student reaches the experience dimension of this process, he realizes, well, I am one with the whole creation. That was the experience where the Buddha, or Jesus, or Shankaracharya, or Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, Vivekananda, all the great teachers of the world, belonging to all traditions, they had this experience when they felt their complete identity and unity with the whole creation. And that experience is enshrined in the fourth Mahavakya, which is called Anubhuti Vakya, means statement of experience called Aham Brahmasmi. That comes in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. So these four statements constitute four stages in the evolution of spiritual life of humanity. All the great teachers, even those who belong to non-Vedic, non-Vedantic traditions, went through this stage. That is how they could sacrifice their life and everything for the good of others. So we will continue this discussion maybe on Sunday, December the 20th, we'll continue the discussion. So thank you. This is so often the word Mahavakya, when you come, is a wonderful Sanskrit term, so obscure, abstract, it may look like that. But these great statements, they correspond to four levels of spiritual evolution of humanity. Thank you. Namaskar.